Welcome to another edition of the ATL Alts Podcast. This is your host, Andre Sindate. I am glad to be here today, and my guest is co-founder and chief investment officer of Three Bulls Capital, Michael Liss. Michael, welcome to the ATL Alts Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me as your guest today, Andres.
Michael, tell us about your background.
Sure. So I've been involved in real estate alongside my father beginning in 1989, when he began his efforts of urban revitalization in the city of Atlanta in a neighborhood called Grant Park. But I have done this investing, first helping him, and then in 2000 going out on my own as a private real estate investor. And I've done it alongside a successful career in global finance. So in 2008, after the financial crisis began, I really saw an opportunity to do what I was doing, but to do it at scale. And I've had that dream since then. And in 2021, realized that dream when I found the right partners.
Okay, great. Well, we have a lot of entrepreneurs and aspiring entrepreneurs that listen to the show, as well as investors who are hopefully tuning into the show. I think they are to get education and inspiration and background in alternative investments in private markets. So we're going to talk a lot about real estate today, and specifically the community-driven investment platform that you and your partners have built with Three Bulls. I want to step back though and ask you about the name. It's a unique name. So tell us about Three Bulls Capital and kind of how did you and your partners come up with that name and what does it represent?
Sure. So I was at the time that that I met Troy Williams, who's our CEO and co-founder. He and I were living in mainland China. And maybe just to rewind a little bit about background, my last role in global finance, I was head of international corporate banking for the Americas for HSBC Bank, and I was living in Shanghai, China. I met Troy. He was introduced through a friend of mine, and he and I became fast friends and running partners. He's also a marathoner. And we began running the Huangpu River together, and discovered that we were investing 45 minutes away from each other in the state of Georgia.
Wow.
In former mill towns. And we discovered this commonality. So we began meeting when we decided that we should explore launching a business together. And we would meet every Sunday at a WeWork office space where he was working. He was head of enterprise services for WeWork China. And we began to develop our plan, whiteboarding it out every single week. And with the genesis of this idea, pulling together, we found that we had so many ideas that really aligned well. The name, of course, was a very important one.
Mm-hmm.
And we discovered that all the founders were born in the Chinese zodiac year of the bull or the ox. We decided that Sanyo Capital, which was in Chinese, wasn't a good name for a very local, investment firm that was playing.
Right.
So yeah. Translated to English, Three Bulls Capital was quite fitting. And we've really created a culture around it within the company about everything that has to do with a bull.
Yeah.
Even concluding some meetings or celebrating things by mooing together. We like to keep it informal and really have a good sense of humor about it.
Yeah, for sure. I want to ask you about the background. So it sounds like your family has a background in real estate, and you had the opportunity to get an early, some early experiences watching family, your dad, invest in real estate. And you talked about Grant Park, a historic neighborhood in Atlanta. Now you're executing on your business in the middle of Georgia. So tell us about the middle of Georgia. A lot of people know Georgia because of our airport and because of our busy port in Savannah, right. Pretty friendly business climate, great universities in Atlanta. But when you get outside of the Metro Atlanta area, mm-hmm. candidly, a lot of people know Georgia for the Barrier Islands or for Augusta every spring with the Masters.
Right.
Tell us more about Middle Georgia and where you have elected and Troy and your team to build the firm before we kind of get into what exactly you're doing with the revitalization of mill towns and how you're bringing those back to life.
Yeah. So Middle Georgia has certainly some unique characteristics to it. There are a number of different similar towns that have common dynamics from, you know, this sort of former mill town ethos mm-hmm. To connectivity through major interstates that are very important transportation arteries for the United States. And we like a lot of those dynamics. But originally, when I was looking for a second home outside of the city of Atlanta, we decided on Griffin, Georgia. Land was cheap. There were historical assets in the town. It had a real charm that reminded me of growing up in my hometown of Roswell, Georgia, except that it seemed like it was decades behind in terms of redevelopment efforts. We liked that and really found the authenticity and the charm and the people welcoming, and we're quite excited to become a part of the community. So initially, my wife and I picked Griffin as a place to have a country house. We had that for several years before we moved to mainland China, and even used it when we came back from China initially, because we had rented out our house in the city of Atlanta. But just 45 minutes drive from the international airport. It was convenient. The pricing was extremely affordable. And while spending time down there, we anticipated originally that we would maybe spend one weekend a month in Griffin. We found ourselves going down every Thursday and returning on Sundays while still living in Atlanta. And as real estate investors do, they find other opportunities in new markets. And what I discovered in 2016, 2017, were that the prices were incredibly inexpensive. And the reason was that assets were trading at a discount. There were
what kind of real estate are we talking about, by the way? Maybe you could talk a little bit about when you say prices.
Sure. So we're talking about single family rentals, duplexes, triplexes, quadruplexes, assets that would be considered non-commercial assets. Mm-hmm. When you get to five units, it becomes a commercial asset. And we discovered there was a very large supply of very inexpensive homes. Our first rentals that we purchased in the market were $15,000, $20,000, $40,000 for a house. And you can't even buy the materials to build a house for those prices.
Right, right.
Interestingly, though, there was sort of this the shadow of economic downturn that had been hanging over the city and other cities like it across the Southeast in these former textile milling towns, where new job creation had begun. However, the housing supply of quality workforce housing was significantly lacking. And it was there that we saw an opportunity.
So to set it up, Middle Georgia, Griffin, and other communities includes Macon, includes what are some of the other communities for those that are maybe not familiar with you know the markets where you're active now?
Sure. So we're heavily in Griffin, Georgia, which we would regard as our home market.
Uh-huh.
We're also in Barnesville, Georgia, which is in Lamar County, just 15 minutes south of us. And we're also in Macon, Georgia, where we are actively exploring new expansion markets.
Got it. And you've mentioned it a couple of times, so I want to give our guests a better understanding of when you set up Three Bulls Capital, you and Troy, turns out we're investing literally from across the world in the same community, or reasonably close. And then you have a local presence, you have a home, and you start noticing all these single family rental opportunities. There's been a lot of capital that's flowed into the single family rental space over the last 15 years since the great financial crisis.
Right.
And I've had multiple real estate investment sponsors on our show that have talked about different ways that they're playing the undersupply of quality housing in America, different ways that they're attacking the single family rental, multifamily rental space. So what I'd love to do is spend some time talking about your strategy and Three Bulls, the setup. You've mentioned former mill towns, middle Georgia, between transportation, in a transportation hub between Savannah and Atlanta.
Right.
But economically, maybe more challenged than in their heyday at the turn of the century. So what is it about these communities beyond pricing that make it attractive from a setup standpoint for what you and Troy and the team are building?
You know, I think it is a multitude of different things that are appealing to us. One, I would say that the populations tend to be fairly sticky in these small towns where people have grown up in the communities. They enjoy their way of life. They're not interested in moving to major cities across the United States. And they find it very attractive. And they like the fact that there isn't traffic of the downtown Atlanta,
sure,
which could leave somebody for an hour and a half in traffic, depending on where you're trying to travel. I would say across the South, the states are highly pro-business.
Right.
So while many of these cities or towns across the former textile milling belt were single industry towns in the past up till around 2000, they have now diversified smartly into both cyclical and non-cyclical industries in terms of creating new job growth. And I would say Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, South Carolina, North Carolina have all had very active economic development programs, even having offices overseas in Korea, Japan, Germany, and various other countries to court new foreign direct investment into these markets. So with the creation of new jobs, there have also been people who see opportunity to redevelop some of the historical assets that make these towns quite appealing in terms of lifestyle. I would say that the collaboration that exists between the Georgia Department of Economic Development, Electric Cities of Georgia, the economic developers at the city and municipal levels has really been a coordinated, cohesive effort, and that they've been successful. I'll give you an example of that. Within Spalding County, we have the Lakes, which is an industrial park. It is almost entirely filled with Japanese companies that have come to Griffin because they see the hardworking labor base. They see the convenience being along the Interstate 75 corridor. We also have Caterpillar has set up manufacturing operations. So the economic redevelopment efforts have really focused on a tapestry of a lot of different types of companies. We're now seeing a 20 million square foot internet distribution center that's being built along Interstate 75. We see Prologis has now developed a business center. We're seeing a lot of these sort of large job creating projects that are coming to fruition. And I think as people who are involved in economic redevelopment efforts focus that going alongside large institutional money, that and universities, hospitals, these are where the jobs are. And those are the people that need better quality housing. And I would say in many of these cities where textile mills used to exist, the textile mills themselves at one point used to own large quantities of mill housing. They were built for the workers. Yep. Around the time of the turn of the century with globalization, many of those jobs went overseas just simply because of labor arbitrage. Egypt, India, Pakistan, Peru, Ecuador, China, Vietnam. We know, you know, we see them on the tags of our clothes now when we buy these clothes that are manufactured overseas. When that happened, many of the properties and large portfolios were sold to produce cash as the industry was, you know, nearing the end of its heyday.
Mm-hmm.
And local landlords ended up purchasing large portfolios. There was a vacuum of hope in many of the towns. And as economic trends were spiraling downward, I think the lack of investment in the homes disappeared. And so many of the homes have significant deferred maintenance issues. And that's where we saw an opportunity. For what we do, I would say what's attractive is it's about meeting an unmet need. And in doing that, we look holistically about the community, about how we can really uplift the community in a positive way. And that means looking at all stakeholders within the community. That means how are we of service to the governments and municipality? How do we coordinate and collaborate with other developers that are involved in the community? And how do we strategize in such a way that will breathe new life and a prospering economy and a better quality of living for people?
Yeah, and you know, look, and for those listening, I can attest to what Michael's describing, having been invited down to spend the day, you know, with you driving around Griffin. And one of the things that, you know, we did is we toured some of the properties, looking at the progress of the redevelopment. And also one thing that really struck me on that trip was there is a charm to the community. There is a local ownership feel that those citizens, those residents have, not just the renters, but the people that have been there for generations. And you could feel that and hear that when driving by. Hey, Michael, good to see you again, type of thing. And then going to the local restaurants and that type of thing. But I want to ask you to put your chief investment officer cap on. When you think about doing this at scale and trying to build Three Bulls Capital up around this particular strategy and put dollars into the ground to acquire, rehabilitate, or renovate these single family homes, and then presumably you're putting them back on the market to rent. What is the sort of setup? It sounds like there was some really tremendous values early in 16. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to 24. Talk about what that process looks like as a CIO when you're building a portfolio.
So what I would say, obviously, you're correct. The discounts were incredible early on. And, you know, I think many people didn't perhaps realize the value and that could be achieved at that point, or perhaps didn't even have belief in their own city. I remember the first couple properties that we purchased and renovated, having lunch with some bankers in town and sharing the results. And they thought it was an anomaly with the amount of rents that we were getting. And I shared with them my belief that there was a strong demand for quality housing. We obviously, you know, we want to provide the best quality product we can with the best service and at a fair price. We're certainly not focused on creating increase in prices without delivering additional value. What we found, and this was part of our investment thesis, was that there is a strong demand and that people will pay for quality product. We found people numerous times that were living in houses where they would walk into the bathroom or we'd walk in and our foot would go through the floor. And we don't consider that to be a quality home that we would want to live in. So, you know, I think as we look at creating value, we want to create homes that we personally would live in. And that's sort of been an underlying guiding principle behind what we've done. But so if you're talking about looking at this from chief investment officer perspective, you know, prices have gone up, but they were trading at such extreme discounts before I think it was just tied directly to people's hope and aspirations for the city. We still see pricing came up significantly during 2021, 2022, and 23. I would say that a lot of institutional players were purchasing, or they were on buying sprees at that time, and that did force pricing up some. We have now, I would say, with rates as high as they are, people have considerably higher cost of capital. So that has slowed some of the purchasing, which we like. It's better for us not to have, even larger institutional competition for those same assets. As we're thinking about where we buy, we tend to buy in a very tight cluster. And that's always been very important in terms of forcing positive change. And rather than a traditional scattered site investment strategy, which a lot of SFR, single family rental players have taken, we like the idea of becoming a market maker. And what that means to me is that you can drive down a street and we can point continuously to assets. I recall early when I started as an investor on my own in 2000, that, you know, I was involved in early revitalization efforts within the city of Atlanta. And as one or two houses would pop up on a street that were being renovated, it would make an impact. But as perhaps five houses were being renovated on the street, then investors really start to jump on because they can see the change that is occurring. And so as we took away our learnings from decades of investing, we really tried to capitalize on that, creating significant momentum, you know, buying a very large cluster together, radically changing the neighborhood for the better. And we've found that other investors are jumping on more quickly. Homeowners are taking better care of their homes. And we're really seeing very dynamic change in these neighborhoods. So we're quite excited. Our investment thesis has been proven to be correct. And I would say our yields, even though pricing has gone up, we have seen prices soften a little bit, particularly for properties that have a lot of friction. And by friction, I mean that they're dilapidated. We're really, we're able to still acquire assets at a reasonable price, apply our three bulls methodology to creating value add and improving them, and to still get appropriate returns. I would say for SFR or single family rental as a sector, these days, typically, if you can get a 6% capitalization rate, then it's considered an acceptable deal. And I would say after we apply our value add, typically on those assets, we're able to get anywhere between a 9% and 12% capitalization rate.
Yeah. So you're getting 300 to 400 basis points lift above kind of market. And arguably in secondary, maybe tertiary markets. So some of those competitive dynamics might be different. Having local relationships with subcontractors, I would think that's different, you know, versus the scattered site approach. I want to ask you about single family rental as a, I don't know if it's an asset class, maybe in and of itself within real estate. There's certainly a lot of capital that's been pursuing it. And we've seen some public companies, Invitation Homes, America Homes for Rent, to name a couple of the big ones. Right. And certainly lots of non-traded REITs and other institutional capital that's aggregating up single family properties. But one of the reasons I wanted to have you on ATL Alts is there's some aspects to what you all are doing at Three Bulls that are different. So one of those you've alluded to, and I'd love to spend time on it, is the community-driven aspect to building, revitalizing neighborhoods and these clusters that you describe. Talk a little bit about what else goes into that. You mentioned city officials and elected officials and the importance of that collaboration. You right. talked about job growth, and you mentioned some of the big examples of companies that were making significant investments and like the labor pool. But again, these folks need a place to live that's affordable relative right. to the wages that the market is going to pay.
Yes.
And so that can be a real challenge for folks, particularly now. We're in a little bit more of an uncertain economic time than maybe 3 or 4 years ago. So talk about that community impact piece and how all of those different stakeholders impact what you guys are building and doing, so that at the end of the day, the investor generates a return, earns a return, but there might be right. more of a double impact element to it as well.
Yeah. So maybe before I dive into that a little bit, I'd like to unpack the history, as I see it, of SFR investing.
Okay.
First, I think that this has long been a mom and pop business.
Yeah.
And the Great Recession really, I think, became evident to large institutional players like Invitation Homes, that these assets were trading at an enormous discount and that there was upside which could be realized as the market recovered. And so I regard that as SFR 1.0. That was, we can buy cheap assets and we'll be able to resell them much higher at a later date. Then 2.0 would be that many of these companies discovered, gosh, these assets actually generate cash. This could be an income product. And so we saw as they expanded their holdings, that, you know, they can create preferred returns for investors and that the returns were attractive. 3.0, I would say, is where many of the larger players are playing right now. And that means that, gosh, we can do this, we can rent homes, we can buy them, and but we through scale can achieve efficiencies and various different cost centers, et cetera. I like to say that Three Bulls is operating in SFR 4.0, and that the way we operate with our community-driven investing model is really a comprehensive look about how are we engaging the community? What does it mean to drive value at a community level? I think by meeting an unmet need, by bringing quality workforce housing to the market, we are answering the demands of the community. We're very much focused on profit because we have investors and we have a fiduciary duty to deliver for them, but we're also we believe by doing the right thing in the community and for the community, delivering places that hardworking Americans need to as a place that they can call home, where they can go home at night, lay their head in a quality place with safe electricity, with new plumbing, with floors and walls that are nice, and we're also doing so in a historically sensitive context. And that's where I think the allure of these historical mill towns is really significant. And I think we are seeing now where people are moving from other cities to become part of the community. And we expect that trend will continue. The pricing is quite attractive. The quality of life is attractive. And we continue to enhance the quality of life in these communities. So that's maybe a historical look on the SFR model that we have. But in terms of how we look at this community-driven investing model, we are experimenting with other adjacent and complementary assets, such as commercial real estate, that really we look at activating communities. So we've all heard about food deserts, mm-hmm. Communities where that are underserved. There aren't any restaurants. There aren't any grocery stores that are present in these communities. And we seek to reactivate, to ignite these communities again by bringing places, gathering places where people can come together and build community. I can look back to my own efforts in East Atlanta Village, where I moved in 2000, and we used to refer to the coffee shop as Town Hall. And we would see all of our neighbors regularly as they would come in to visit and converse with each other. And that's where relationships were really formed, was at the coffee shop, at the restaurants, and other community places where neighbors could come together and bond and get to know each other. And it's about people of diverse backgrounds coming together and getting to know each other as well. And those sort of spaces are, we view, absolutely critical towards uplifting neighborhoods. And ultimately, home ownership is absolutely crucial as well. So, you know, as we look at our own portfolio and what we hope to achieve in the communities, the markets that we're invested in are usually 65% renters, which is the inverse of the national average for home ownership. Across the United States, 65% of the homes are owned by people. And we seek to change that in the markets where we're active. And that is part of our actual exit plan, is that we will groom and coach and provide people with the necessary resources that already exist. It's really about directing traffic and connecting people with resources, banks, home improvement stores, all mm-hmm. that are interested in these efforts of creating new home ownership. So, you know, I think as we see the transition from 65% renters to more homeowners, that will drive neighborhood pride and ownership. And we feel that the properties that we own, when people drive by, they should not be able to tell that it is a rental property. And we've employed a very simple philosophy that I've used since I began in this business, is as long as three things happen, the landlord-tenant relationship should always work. People pay rent on time, they take care of their homes, and if something breaks, we're going to fix it as quickly as possible. And it's a fairly simple relationship that has been enormously complicated by lots of different factors. So what that means to us is that people are taking care of their homes. They're not parking on the lawns. The front of the house is kept neat and clean. And that they're treating it as if it is their own. And we do that through routine inspections, drive-bys, just to make sure that our standard is really uplifting the community in a positive way.
Yeah, one of the things that I wanted to talk about, that as I did more diligence and I look at a lot of different alternative investment offerings and sponsors, both fundless sponsors and also those with platforms that are doing multiple funds. And often the earlier stage managers and sponsors are very focused on building a track record, executing deals, maybe setting up their first offering and obviously raising capital. But you don't often see as much of an understanding or appreciation for the less glamorous parts of building a fund platform, you know, the back office, the reporting, the governance, the counterparty risk. What was it about you and Troy and the team from a very early stage that allowed you guys to have the insight or the foresight to say, we're going to set this up this way from the very beginning? Curious, you know, did you get advice from lawyers? Had you been through prior experiences, investors? What was it that allowed you guys to kind of architect your organization? And I would say in a very institutional-like way, given your size.
Thank you. Yeah, so what I would say on that note is that we've always been building a platform for scale. We've always envisioned ourselves significantly larger. While we're playing in Middle Georgia right now, I anticipate that at some point in the future, we will expand into the neighboring states that have similar dynamics. And we believe similar opportunities to be met within the communities where we operate and serve, and that we believe we can affect large scale change through our model. So I would say in terms of choosing the fund model, we did talk to quite a few different people. We did speak with attorneys and accountants and really did a lot of diligence early on. Also, I would say that, people that are involved on the board have had experience running funds and come from an asset management background. Our chairman, for example, was executive vice president for Franklin Templeton Asia out of Hong Kong. And so we've had some experience I think through our organization and people that are involved with it to understand the investment side of the business and how some of the mechanics operate. Obviously, I would say, you know, as we grow in scale, that continues to be a strong consideration for us. And as we potentially explore launching another fund, what does that mean if we were, for example, the launch of 506C, where general solicitations are allowed. Obviously documentation is quite important. I would say one of the biggest driving factors is we knew this model had to be done at scale, mm-hmm. and we needed to be able to move quickly. So that meant that there was a need for a reasonable amount of capital to be deployed. And that, so you brought this up, and I think very intelligently to point this out, is that prices have gone up. And by the time we're sort of mid-stage with uplifting a community, it gets more and more difficult to find good deals. And generally, the last house you buy in that market will be the most expensive if you're really creating value. Obviously, there is some external influence between, you know, market liquidity, interest rates, what some of the trend of the larger institutional players, Wall Street funds and REITs are doing that will drive pricing. So those are some cyclical factors, but the non-cyclical factors, the real value creation within these communities, will by virtue of what we're achieving, will drive up those prices. So
let me ask you, is it fair to say, Michael, that maybe in a very early version of, even if it was before Three Bulls Capital, when maybe you and Troy were just buying in the markets where you're active today through a fund platform, is it fair to say that a lot of value was just, you just on purchase, your basis was so attractive that that reasonable management, reasonable rehab costs could get you a very attractive cap rate exit yield. Today, is it fair to say that there's more of a value creation imperative for buying correctly and value creation? It kind of gets to like, is the renter still willing to pay what they were able to pay or willing to pay a little bit more for that? You know, I don't know if it's the term is premium product in your lexicon, but I'm just curious from a private equity and financial engineering standpoint, you know, you hear a lot about, well, it was all financial engineering early for a lot of these buyout firms and a lot of these P shops. And now it's, you've got to have value engineering. You've got to have operators. You got to have vertical integration. You got to have all these things in house. I'm curious how that's played out in the single family rental space within your markets.
So you touched on a couple different points. I would say buying right is absolutely, it's absolutely critical. It was important early in 2016 and 2017 as I was floating a number of different test projects, bringing in partners on various investments that we made in those markets. Buying right continues to be absolutely crucial for us. We have to purchase right. You know, if you think about the IRR formula, we have to buy as inexpensively as we can. We have to carefully watch our costs on the CapEx investment, but making significant investments that really create a quality place for people to live. So that really requires us to be accurate on the onset of determining what those budgets are and then closely monitoring those budgets. It also, it also involves us acting with speed. Being able to renovate a house in 4 to 6 weeks is really important for us to be able to move swiftly. And then, you know, if you think about the cash flows in the IRR formula, is that we have to carefully manage our ongoing management costs, our maintenance CapEx and repair and maintenance budgets. Also, we have to carefully manage our vacancy rate. And I would say we continue to float somewhere around 97-98% of all available homes. I think last time I looked, we were at 99% occupancy of all our available homes. So it's rigorous management of that.
You gotta,
yeah, absolutely.
You gotta be collecting rent.
We have to be, and this goes back to having people meet their obligations on time. You know, particularly if people don't communicate with us, that's where we tend to have friction. But collecting the rents on time, and then at the disposition, it will also be really important that we properly market, that our assets are in tip-top shape, and that we're able to get the terminal value or the sale price in the IRR that makes sense for our investors. So you touched on this. Vertical integration is, we believe, absolutely crucial and always has been a cornerstone to how we operate, because with our community-driven investment model, we have a very high standard that we felt like we needed to achieve. And the best way for us to do that was to control those variables. And we've seen other funds that have undertaken this, and some that have operated in some of the same markets that where we play, and that use third-party managers. And had high vacancies, just weren't getting the consistency, and now have pivoted to more towards our model. We do all of our property management in-house because it is so crucial. And we also do our construction in-house as well. So we have a general licensed general contractor who is on staff, and we use a number of independent contractors to actually execute the construction. We've run as many as 10 crews at the same time. And through experience, we continue to work with the very best of the ones that we have experience with.
Fascinating. A few more questions. I think we can all learn a lot from, you know, from mistakes, oversights. Obviously, the market constantly is presenting challenges. Who knows what the Fed's going to do this year with rates, right? For example, but practical lived experience is often valuable. They say the industry that we're in is an apprenticeship business, you know, and you learn from doing and watching and getting your hands dirty. Would you be willing to share a few of the important lessons learned if you were talking to a room full of aspiring sponsors or fund managers or a team out there that's thinking about stepping out and building their platform from your and Troy and your team's experience at Three Bulls Capital?
So, absolutely. What I would say is, when thinking about a business like this, the work is hard. Many people think that they're going to become incredibly successful in whatever they do overnight. What they don't see is the grinding and the hard work that's involved. I can recall back to the days of the financial crisis. Rents dropped, values dropped. I was literally crawling under houses myself to fix pipes and to do repairs. When Troy and I set out on this, he and I were doing all of the property management ourselves. This is before we didn't have the scale and the operations set up to be able to pay other people at a smaller scale. So we literally were turning screwdrivers and drills and we weren't doing the renovations ourselves, but property management, we hadn't achieved the scale. So I think the first thing is know that it takes grit and willingness to take on everything in the early days before you're able to hire the right people or have the resources to hire the right people. I think it takes thriftiness as well. We, for a year and a half, we operated the business out of a space above my horse stables at my house. It was free rent, and it was practical for us at the time. So, you know, continuously watching costs, really being thrifty about how you're operating, and frankly, I think investors were receptive to that as well, because they saw that we were being thrifty with their money. And focused on delivering for our investors. That's the second item. The third, be willing to endure pain. What being an Ironman triathlete, marathon runner, and ultra marathon runner has taught me, and I know Troy is the same, is that many times we have long periods of extended pain before we get to where we want to be. And so that takes, it takes resilience physically and emotionally, and being laser focused on the future. And the fourth point I would leave you with is, in terms of takeaways that are worth sharing, I recall in my days as a banker, before I worked my way up to becoming an international corporate banker, banking some of the largest companies in the Americas, I began early on as a business banker back in my earlier days. And I always marveled at the optimism that entrepreneurs have. And as bankers, we learn to become very cynical mm-hmm. and to question everything and all of the assumptions that were shown to us and all of the beautiful pitch decks and lofty ambitions. Now, being on the other side of that, we set some very aspirational goals, I would say, at the beginning. And we've achieved. I'm proud of what we've achieved. What we've achieved in the time period that we have, but we didn't grow as quickly as we thought we would. And you know, I think if you don't set your sights high with high goals, that if you set mediocre goals, that those you'll fall short. So I think it's good to have two sets of goals: one that you show bankers and other people externally, and then to have your own set of goals internally in terms of what you're going to accomplish. So it's good to under promise and over deliver when it comes to bankers or you know, other stakeholders in terms of internally where you're focused. Your North Star is you have to aim high, and even if you fall short, you're going to accomplish something magnificent.
Do something meaningful. Well, and I think also COVID, it seemed like there was a lot of solo GP kind of, I'm going to step out and do this, build a brand. And now I feel like there's a recognition that it's just a super complex business, and having a team, having a board, having a network, like you guys have built, probably is a real core asset. We didn't talk as much about the team, but you don't have right. a small team. So I want to give you the last word before we wrap up, Michael. And you touched on it with that fourth point, which is the goals and the optimism and the desire to do things internally. You don't have to share anything confidential, but you did allude to expanding the platform and looking at adjacent markets, nearby states. What gets you most excited about taking Three Bulls Capital's strategy of revitalizing former mill towns throughout the Southeast? What gets you most excited based on whether it's, we've talked about the pricing, we've talked about the dynamics. We haven't talked as much about investors and their receptivity to what you're doing, but I know you're growing. But right. I'd love for you to share, you know, I like leaving these shows on a real positive note, both for you and for me and for our guests, but real estate's, It's a tough business right now, and I also want to be real. But I'll leave you with the last word to share kind of what gets you and Troy and the team invigorated to continue to grind.
I would say it is affecting positive change in the communities that we serve. It's being able to do that, to create real social impact, and simultaneously to be able to serve our investors. The idea that we have a proven investment thesis and that we are actually providing a service for the communities that we serve and that it's well received tells me, and the demand is there, it tells me that what we're doing works. And we've been very thoughtful about formulating our investment platform and creating everything to build for scale so that we can expand and that we can serve other markets. And that really, hearing the feedback that we're getting from people within the communities, the positive feedback is, I think it's just affirmation that we are really meeting an unmet need and that we can create a legacy of positive change. And I think many of us, when we look back on our lives and we think about what did I accomplish? Who did I serve? I think many of us spend our lives working hard so that we can serve our families. And but the question that I continuously ask myself and that we challenge our team with is, how can we be of service to others? And I believe strongly that meeting this unmet need of quality workforce housing has just significantly lacked, or it's lagged behind the creation of new jobs. And we can be of service to help to rebuild the former textile milling belt in the United States. And I see this as I talk to investment bankers on Wall Street, other fund managers that are running multi-billion dollar funds. What we have and what we have created is unique. They've not heard this story told before or seen the results produced in this way. And I would say, maybe just touching back to one other point that you made earlier about financial engineering within the industry, is that we look seriously at that, is that if the underlying investment thesis is not good, adding financial gearing to it or lots of debt in order to make the numbers look significantly better still doesn't make a good deal or make a bad deal good. So that what we're doing in isolation by itself without debt has to stand on its own and be a good investment. By applying a moderate amount of leverage, we're able to amplify the impact. But I would say we are among the most conservative in the sector in terms of our debt profile. Just simply managing that, we don't want, we want to take a good deal and make it even better. It doesn't need to have numbers that make people's mouth drop. You know, in 2021, when we launched Three Bulls, we were competing against investment decks and other investors that were showing staggering returns. And now we're seeing many of those companies are really struggling, particularly with increased costs of debt. You know, market liquidity has changed, and we're in a period of transition where there's a dislodgement between buyers and sellers and price. And, you know, that will eventually moderate. But I think it's an exciting time for us, and I think it's an exciting time for us to expand.
That's great. Well, based in Griffin, Georgia, Michael Liss, co-founder and chief investment officer of Three Bulls Capital, I want to thank you for just giving us a real solid overview of the single family rental business. That historical perspective is terrific. Also, just to going into the detail you did about the impact that you guys are having there in Griffin and some of the adjacent communities. I think a lot of times, what's most attractive to having founders and entrepreneurs on like you is having grown up in the middle of the country like I did. And it's called the flyover state, you know, Kansas and the flyover states. What you guys are doing, and when I meet managers and sponsors that are doing something to bring back or bring recognition and opportunity to overlooked markets, means something to me. So I look forward to following what you all are doing, continuing to highlight you, maybe through you guys coming back on the show and sharing updates with our listeners. But unfortunately, we're out of time, so we'll leave it there for today. But I want to thank you, Michael, for joining me today as a guest on the ATL Wealth Podcast.
Yep. Thank you. And I just want to thank you for what you're doing in terms of exposure in the alternative investment space. I think it's fantastic. And really appreciate your presence and knowledge within this sphere.
Yeah.
So thank
you. Well, glad to have you on. We'll look forward to doing an update soon, Michael. Thanks for joining me.
Great. Thank you very much.